from it. I stopped, took a deep breath, and forced myself towards the door, determined to see what the fiend had done here. Well, the stench was nothing to the sight of it. In a deep prison cell lay a heap of corpses in all states of decay, the bones and rotting flesh crawling with worms and insects. Rats ran from the light of the torch, brushing past my legs as they made for the stairs, and my nausea became a knot in my throat. The stench suffocated me. But I couldn't stop staring at these bodies. There was something important here, something terribly important to be realized. And it came to me suddenly that all these dead victims had been men. Their boots and ragged clothing gave evidence of that, and every single one of them had yellow hair, very much like my own. The few who had features left appeared to be young men, tall, slight of build, and the most recent occupant here, the wet and reeking corpse that lay with its arms outstretched through the bars, so resembled me that he might have been a brother. In a daze, I moved forward until the tip of my boot touched his head. I lowered my torch, my mouth opening as if to scream. The wet, sticky eyes that swarmed with gnats were blue eyes. I stumbled backwards. A wild fear gripped me that the thing would move, grab hold of my ankle. And I knew why it would. As I drew up against the wall, I tripped on a plate of rotted food and a pitcher. The pitcher went over and broke, and out of it the curdled milk spilled like vomit. Pain circled my ribs. Blood came up like liquid fire into my mouth, and it shot out of my lips, splashing on the floor in front of me. I had to reach for the open door to steady myself, but through the haze of nausea I stared at the blood. I stared at the gorgeous crimson color of it in the light of the torch. I watched the blood darken as it sank into the mortar between the stones. The blood was alive, and the sweet smell of it cut like a blade through the stench of the dead. Spasms of thirst drove away the nausea. My back was arching. I was bending lower and lower to the blood with astonishing elasticity. And all the while my thoughts raced. This young man had been alive in this cell. This rotted food and milk were here either to nourish or torment him. He had died in the cell, trapped with those corpses, knowing full well he would soon be one of them. God, to suffer that! To suffer that! And how many others had known exactly the same fate? Young men with yellow hair, all of them. I was down on my knees and bending over. I held the torch low with my left hand, and my head went all the way down to the blood, my tongue lashing out of my mouth so that I saw it like the tongue of a lizard. It scraped at the blood on the floor. Shivers of ecstasy. Oh, too lovely! Was I doing this? Was I lapping up this blood not 2 inches from this dead body? Was my heart heaving with every taste not 2 inches from this dead boy whom Magnus had brought here as he brought me? This boy that Magnus had then condemned to death instead of immortality. The filthy cell flickered on and off like a flame as I licked up the blood. The dead man's hair touched my forehead. His eye, like a fractured crystal, stared at me. Why wasn't I locked in this cell? What test had I passed that I was not screaming now as I shook the bars, the horror that I had foreseen in the village inn slowly closing in on me? The blood tremors passed through my arms and legs, and the sound I heard, the gorgeous sound, as enthralling as the crimson of the blood, the blue of the boy's eye, the glistening wings of the gnat, the sliding opaline body of the worm, the blaze of the torch, was my own raw and guttural screaming. I dropped the torch and struggled backwards on my knees, crashing against the tin plate and the broken pitcher. I climbed to my feet and ran up the stairway, and as I slammed shut the dungeon door, my screams rose up and up to the very top of the tower. I was lost in the sound as it bounced off the stones and came back at me. I couldn't stop, couldn't close my mouth or cover it. But through the barred entranceway and through a dozen narrow windows above, I saw the unmistakable light of morning coming. My screams died. The stones had begun to glow. The light seeped around me like scalding steam, burning my eyelids. I made no decision to run. I was simply doing it, running up and up to the inner chamber. As I came out of the passage, the room was full of a dim purple fire. The jewels overflowing the chest appeared to be moving. I was almost blind as I lifted the lid of the sarcophagus. Quickly, it fell into place above me. The pain in my face and hands died away, and I was still, and I was safe. And fear and sorrow melted into a cool and fathomless darkness. 7. It was thirst that awakened me, and I knew at once where I was, and what I was too. There were no sweet mortal dreams of chilled white wine, or the fresh green grass beneath the apple trees in my father's orchard. In the narrow darkness of the stone coffin, I felt of my fangs with my fingers, and found them dangerously long and keen as little knife blades. And a mortal was in the tower, and though he hadn't reached the door of the outer chamber, I could hear his thoughts. I heard his consternation when he discovered the door to the stairs unlocked. That had never happened before. I heard his fear as he discovered the burnt timbers on the floor, and called out, "Master!" A servant was what he was, and a somewhat treacherous one at that. It fascinated me, this soundless hearing of his mind, but something else was disturbing me. It was his scent. I lifted the stone lid of the sarcophagus and climbed out. The scent was faint, but it was almost irresistible. It was the musky smell of the first hoard in whose bed I had spent my passion. It was the roasted venison after days and days of starvation in winter. It was new wine, or fresh apples, or water roaring over a cliff's edge on a hot day when I reached out to gulp it in handfuls. Only it was immeasurably richer than that, this scent, and the appetite that wanted it was infinitely keener and more simple. I moved through the secret tunnel like a creature swimming through the darkness, and pushing out the stone in the outer chamber, rose to my feet. There stood the mortal, staring at me, his face pale with shock. An old, withered man he was, and by some indefinable tangle of considerations in his mind, I knew he was a stable master and a coachman, but the hearing of this was maddeningly imprecise. Then the immediate malice he felt towards me came like the heat of a stove, and there was no misunderstanding that. His eyes raced over my face and form. The hatred boiled, crested. It was he who had procured the fine clothes I wore. He who had tended the unfortunates in the dungeon while they had lived. And why, he demanded in silent outrage, was I not there? This made me love him very much, as you can imagine. I could have crushed him to death in my bare hands for this. "The master," he said desperately. "Where is he? Master!" But what did he think the master was? A sorcerer of some king, that was what he thought. And now I had the power. In sum, he didn't know anything that would be of use to me. But as I comprehended all this, as I drank it up from his mind quite against his will, I was becoming entranced with veins in his face and in his hands, and that smell was intoxicating me. I could feel the dim throbbing of his heart. And then I could taste his blood, just what it would be like, and there came to me some full-blown sense of it, rich and hot as it filled me. "The master's gone, burned in the fire," I murmured, hearing a strange monotone coming from myself. I moved slowly towards him. He glanced at the blackened floor. He looked up at the blackened ceiling. "No, this is a lie," he said. He was outraged, and his anger pulsed like a light in my eye. I felt the bitterness of his mind and its desperate reasoning. Ah, but that living flesh could look like this. I was in the grip of remorseless appetite. And he knew it. In some wild and unreasoning way, he sensed it, and throwing me one last malevolent glance, he ran for the stairway. Immediately I caught him. In fact, I enjoyed catching him, so simple it was. One instant I was willing myself to reach out and close the distance between us. The next I had him helpless in my hands, holding him off the floor so that his feet swung free, straining to kick me. I held him as easily as a powerful man might hold a child. That was the proportion. His mind was a jumble of frantic thoughts, and he seemed unable to decide upon any course to save himself, but the faint humming of these thoughts was being obliterated by the vision he presented to me. His eyes weren't the portals of his soul any more. They were gelatinous orbs whose colors tantalized me, and his body was nothing but a writhing morsel of hot flesh and blood that I must have or die without. It horrified me that this food should be alive, that delicious blood should flow through these struggling arms and fingers, and then it seemed perfect that it should. He was what he was, and I was what I was, and I was going to feast upon him. I pulled him to my lips. I tore the bulging artery in his neck. The blood hit the roof of my mouth. I gave a little cry as I crushed him against me. It wasn't the burning fluid the master's blood had been, not that lovely elixir I had drunk from the stones of the dungeon. No, that had been light itself made liquid. Rather, this was a thousand times more luscious, tasting of the thick human heart that pumped it, the very essence of that hot, almost smoky scent. I could feel my shoulders rising, my fingers biting deeper into his flesh, and almost a humming sound rising out of me. No vision but that of his tiny, gasping soul, but a swoon so powerful that he himself, what he was, had no part in it. It was with all my will that, before the final moment, I forced him away. How I wanted to feel his heart stop. How I wanted to feel the beats slow and cease, and know I possessed him. But I didn't dare. He slipped heavily from my arms, his limbs sprawling out on the stones, the whites of his eyes showing beneath his half-closed eyelids. And I found myself unable to turn away from his death, mutely fascinated by it. Not the smallest detail must escape me. I heard his breath give out. I saw the body relax into death without struggle. The blood warmed me. I felt it beating in my veins. My face was hot against the palms of my hands, and my vision had grown powerfully sharp. I felt strong beyond all imagining. I picked up the corpse and dragged it down and down the winding steps of the tower into the stinking dungeon, and threw it to rot with the rest there. 8. It was time to go. Time to test my powers. I filled my purse and my pockets with as much money as they would comfortably hold, and I buckled on a jeweled sword that was not too old-fashioned, and then went down, locking the iron gate to the tower behind me. The tower was obviously all that remained of a ruined house, but I picked up the scent of horses on the wind, strong, very nice smell, perhaps the way an animal would pick up the scent, and I made my way silently around the back to a makeshift stable. It contained not only a handsome old carriage, but 4 magnificent black mares. Perfectly wonderful that they weren't afraid of me. I kissed their smooth flanks and their long, soft noses. In fact, I was so in love with them I could have spent hours just learning all I could of them through my new senses, but I was eager for other things. There was a human in the stable also, and I'd caught his scent too as soon as I entered. But he was sound asleep, and when I roused him, I saw he was a dull-witted boy who posed no danger to me. "I'm your master now," I said as I gave him a gold coin, "but I won't be needing you tonight, except to saddle a horse for me." He understood well enough to tell me there was no saddle in the stable before he fell back to dozing. All right. I cut the long carriage reins from one of the bridles, put it on the most beautiful of the mares myself, and rode out bareback. I can't tell you what it was like. The burst of the horse under me, the chilling wind, and the high arch of the night sky. My body was melded to animal. I was flying over the snow, laughing aloud and now and then singing. I hit high notes I had never reached before, then plunged into a lustrous baritone. Sometimes I was simply crying out in something like joy. It had to be joy. But how could a monster feel joy? I wanted to ride to Paris, of course. But I knew I wasn't ready. There was too much I didn't know about my powers yet. and so I rode in the opposite direction until I came to the outskirts of a small village. There were no humans about, and as I approached the little church, I felt a human rage and impulsiveness breaking through my strange, translucent happiness. I dismounted quickly and tried the sacristy door. Its lock gave, and I walked through the nave to the communion rail. I don't know what I felt at this moment. Maybe I wanted something to happen. I felt murderous, and lightning did not strike. I stared at the red glare of the vigil lights on the altar. I looked up at the figures frozen in the unilluminated blackness of the stained glass. And in desperation I went up over the communion rail and put my hands on the tabernacle itself. I broke open its tiny little doors, and I reached in and took out the jeweled ciborium with its consecrated hosts. No, there was no power here. Nothing that I could feel or see or know with any of my monstrous senses. Nothing that responded to me. There were wafers and gold and wax and light. I bowed my head on the altar. I must have looked like the priest in the middle of Mass. Then I shut up everything in the tabernacle again. I closed it all up just fine, so nobody would know a sacrilege had been committed. And then I made my way down one side of the church and up the other, the lurid paintings and statues captivating me. I realized I was seeing the process of the sculptor and the painter, not merely the creative miracle. I was seeing the way the lacquer caught the light. I was seeing little mistakes in perspective, flashes of unexpected expressiveness. What will the great masters be to my eyes, I was thinking. I found myself staring at the simplest designs painted in the plaster walls. Then I knelt down to look at the patterns in the marble, until I realized I was stretched out, staring wide-eyed at the floor under my nose. This is getting out of hand, surely. I got up, shivering a little and crying a little and looking at the candles as if they were alive, and getting very sick of this. Time to get out of this place and go into the village. For 2 hours I was in the village, and for most of that time I was not seen or heard by anyone. I found it absurdly easy to jump over the garden walls, to spring from the earth to low rooftops. I could leap from a height of 3 stories to the ground, and climb the side of a building, digging my nails and my toes into the mortar between the stones. I peered in windows. I saw couples asleep in their ruffled beds, infants dozing in cradles, old women sewing by feeble light. And the houses looked like dollhouses to me in their completeness. Perfect collections of toys, with their dainty little wooden chairs and polished mantelpieces, mended curtains and well-scrubbed floors. I saw all this as one who had never been a part of life, gazing lovingly at the simplest details, a starched white apron on its hook, worn boots on the hearth, a pitcher beside a bed. And the people. Oh, the people were marvels! Of course I picked up their scent, but I was satisfied, and it didn't make me miserable. Rather, I doted upon their pink skin and delicate limbs, the precision with which they moved, the whole process of their lives, as if I had never been one of them at all. That they had 5 fingers on each hand seemed remarkable. They yawned, cried, shifted in sleep. I was entranced with them. And when they spoke, the thickest walls could not prevent me from hearing their words. But the most beguiling aspect of my explorations was that I heard the thoughts of these people, just as I had heard the evil servant whom I killed. Unhappiness, misery, expectation. These were currents in the air, some weak, some frighteningly strong, some no more than a glimmer gone before I knew the source. But I could not, strictly speaking, read minds. Most trivial thought was veiled from me, and when I lapsed into my own considerations, even the strongest passions did not intrude. In some, it was intense feeling that carried thought to me, and only when I wished to receive it. And there were some minds that even in the heat of anger gave me nothing. These discoveries jolted me and almost bruised me, as did the common beauty everywhere I looked, the splendor in the ordinary. But I knew perfectly well there was an abyss behind it into which I might quite suddenly and helplessly drop. After all, I wasn't one of these warm and pulsing miracles of complication and innocence. They were my victims. Time to leave the village. I'd learned enough here. But just before I left, I performed one final act of daring. I couldn't help myself, I just had to do it. Pulling up the high collar of my red cloak, I went into the inn, sought a corner away from the fire, and ordered a glass of wine. Everyone in the little place gave me the eye, but not because they knew there was a supernatural being in their midst. They were merely glancing at the richly dressed gentleman. And for 20 minutes I remained, testing it even further. No one, not even the man who served me, detected anything. Of course, I didn't touch the wine. One whiff of it, and I knew that my body could not abide it. But the point was, I could fool mortals. I could move among them. I was jubilant when I left the inn. As soon as I reached the woods, I started to run, and then I was running so fast that the sky and the trees had become a blur. I was almost flying. Then I stopped, leapt, danced about. I gathered up stones and threw them so far I could not see them land. And when I saw a fallen tree limb thick and full of sap, I picked it up and broke it over my knee as if it were a twig. I shouted, then sang at the top of my lungs again. I collapsed on the grass, laughing. And then I rose, tore off my cloak and my sword, and commenced to turn cartwheels. I turned cartwheels just like the acrobats at Renault's. And then I somersaulted, perfectly. I did it again, and this time backwards, and then forward. And then I turned double somersaults and triple somersaults, and leapt straight up in the air some 15 feet off the ground before landing squarely on my feet, somewhat out of breath, and wanting to do these tricks some more. But the morning was coming. Only the subtlest change in the air, the sky, but I knew it as if hell's bells were ringing. Hell's bells calling the vampire home to the sleep of death. Ah, the melting loveliness of the sky. The loveliness of the vision of dim belfries. And an odd thought came to me, that in hell the light of the fires would be so bright it would be like sunlight, and this would be the only sunlight I would ever see again. But what have I done? I thought. I didn't ask for this. I didn't give in. Even when Magnus told me I was dying, I fought him. And yet I am hearing hell's bells now. Well, who gives a damn? When I reached the churchyard, quite ready for the ride home, something distracted me. I stood holding the rein of my horse and looking at the small field of graves and could not quite figure what it was. Then again it came, and I knew. I felt a distinct presence in the churchyard. I stood so still I heard the blood thundering in my veins. It wasn't human, this presence. It had no scent. And there were no human thoughts coming from it. Rather, it seemed veiled and defended, and it knew I was here. It was watching me. Could I be imagining this? I stood listening, looking. A scattering of great tombstones poked through the snow, and far away stood a row of old crypts, larger, ornamented, but just as ruined as the stones. It seemed the presence lingered somewhere near the crypts, and then I felt it distinctly as it moved towards the enclosing trees. "Who are you?" I demanded. I heard my voice like a knife. "Answer me!" I called out even louder. I felt a great tumult in it, this presence, and I was certain that it was moving away very rapidly. I dashed across the churchyard after it, and I could feel it receding, yet I saw nothing in the barren forest. And I realized I was stronger than it, and that it had been afraid of me. Well, fancy that. Afraid of me. And I had no idea whether or not it was corporeal, vampire the same as I was, or something without a body. "Well, one thing is sure," I said. "You're a coward." Tingling in the air, the forest seemed to breathe for an instant. A sense of my own might came over me that had been brewing all along. I was in fear of nothing, not the church, not the dark, not the worms swarming over the corpses in my dungeon, nor even the strange eerie force that had retreated into the forest and seemed to be near at hand again, not even of men. I was an extraordinary fiend. If I'd been sitting on the steps of hell with my elbows on my knees and the devil had said, "Lestat, come, choose the form of the fiend you wish to be to roam the earth," how could I have chosen a better fiend than what I was? And it seemed suddenly that suffering was an idea I'd known in another existence, and would never know again. I can't help but laugh now when I think of that first night, especially of that particular moment. 9. The next night I went tearing into Paris with as much gold as I could carry. The sun had just sunk beneath the horizon when I opened my eyes, and a clear azure light still emanated from the sky as I mounted and rode off to the city. I was starving, and as luck would have it, I was attacked by Cutthroat before I ever reached the city walls. He came thundering out of the woods, pistol blazing, and I actually saw the ball leave the barrel of the gun and go past me, as I leapt off my horse and went at him. He was a powerful man, and I was astonished at how much I enjoyed his cursing and struggling. The vicious servant I'd taken last night had been old. This was a hard, young body. Even the roughness of his badly shaven beard tantalized me, and I loved the strength in his hands as he struck at me. But it was no sport. He froze as I sank my teeth into the artery, and when the blood came it was pure voluptuousness. In fact, it was so exquisite that I forgot completely about drawing away before the heart stopped. We were on our knees in the snow together, and it was a wallop, the life going into me with the blood. I couldn't move for a long moment. Broke the rules already, I thought. Am I supposed to die now? Doesn't look like that is going to happen. Just this rolling delirium. And the poor dead bastard in my arms who would have blown my face off with his pistol if I had let him. I kept staring at the darkening sky, at the great spangled mass of shadows ahead that was Paris, and there was only this warmth after, and obviously increasing strength. So far, so good. I climbed to my feet and wiped my lips, then I pitched the body as far as I could across the unbroken snow. I was more powerful than ever. And for a little while I stood there, feeling gluttonous and murderous, just wanting to kill again so this ecstasy would go on forever. But I couldn't have drunk any more blood, and gradually I grew calm and changed somewhat. A desolate feeling came over me, an aloneness as though the thief had been a friend to me or kin to me and had deserted me. I couldn't understand it, except that the drinking had been so intimate. His scent was on me now, and I sort of liked it. But there he lay, yards away on the crumpled crust of the snow, hands and face looking grey under the rising moon. Hell, the son of a bitch was going to kill me, wasn't he? Within an hour I had found a capable attorney, name of Pierre Roger, at his home in the Marais, an ambitious young man with a mind that was completely open to me. Greedy, clever, conscientious. Exactly what I wanted. Not only could I read his thoughts when he wasn't talking, but he believed everything I told him. He was most eager to be a service to the husband of an heiress from Saint-Domingue. And certainly he would put out all the candles, save one, if my eyes were still hurting from tropical fever. As for my fortune in gems, he dealt with the most reputable jewellers. Bank accounts and letters of exchange for my family in the Auvergne? Yes, immediately. This was easier than playing Lelio. But I was having a hell of a time concentrating. Everything was a distraction. The smoky flame of the candle on the brass inkstand, the gilded pattern of the Chinese wallpaper, and Monsieur Roger's amazing little face with its eyes glistening behind tiny octagonal spectacles. His teeth kept making me think of clavier keys. Ordinary objects in the room appeared to dance. A chest stared at me with its brass knobs for eyes, and a woman singing in an upstairs room over the low rumble of a stove seemed to be saying something in a low and vibrant secret language, such as, "Come to me." But it was going to be this way forever, apparently, and I had to get myself in hand. Money must be sent by courier this very night to my father and my brothers, and to Nicolas de L'Enfant, a musician with Renaud's House of Thespians, who was to be told only that the wealth had come from his friend Lestat de Liancourt. It was Lestat de Liancourt's wish that Nicolas de L'Enfant move at once to a decent flat on the Ile Saint-Louis, or some other proper place, and Roger should, of course, assist in this, and thereafter Nicolas de L'Enfant should study the violin. Roger should buy for Nicolas de L'Enfant the best available violin, a Stradivarius. And finally a separate letter was to be written to my mother, the Marquise Gabrielle de Liancourt, in Italian, so that no one else could read it, and a special purse was to be sent to her. If she could undertake a journey to southern Italy, the place where she'd been born, maybe she could stop the course of her consumption. It made me positively dizzy to think of her with the freedom to escape. I wondered what she would think about it. For a long moment I didn't hear anything, Roger said. I was picturing her dressed for once in her life as the Marquise she was, and riding out of the gates of our castle in her own coach and six. And then I remembered her ravaged face, and heard the cough in her lungs as if she were here with me. "Send the letter and the money to her tonight," I said. "I don't care what it costs. Do it." I laid down enough gold to keep her in comfort for a lifetime, if she had a lifetime. "Now," I said, "do you know of a merchant who deals in fine furnishings, paintings, tapestries, someone who might open his shops and storehouses to us this very evening?" "Of course, monsieur. Allow me to get my coat. We shall go immediately." We were headed for the Faubourg Saint-Denis within minutes, and for hours after that I roamed with my mortal attendants through a paradise of material wealth, claiming everything that I wanted, couches and chairs, china and silver plate, drapery and statuary, all things were mine for the taking. And in my mind I transformed the castle where I'd grown up, as more and more goods were carried out to be crated and shipped south immediately. To my little nieces and nephews I sent toys of which they'd never dreamed, tiny ships with real sails, dollhouses of unbelievable craft and perfection. I learned from each thing that I touched, and there were moments when all the color and texture became too lustrous, too overpowering. I wept inwardly. But I would have got away with playing human to the hilt during all this time, except for one very unfortunate mishap. At one point, as we wandered through the warehouse, a rat appeared, as bold city rats will, racing along the wall very close to us. I stared at it. Nothing unusual, of course. But there, amid plaster and hardwood and embroidered cloth, the rat looked marvellously particular. And the men, misunderstanding, of course, began fumbling frantic apologies for the rat and stamping their feet to drive it away from us. To me, their voices became a mixture of sounds like stew bubbling in a pot. All I could think was that the rat had very tiny feet, and that I had not yet examined the rat, nor any small, warm-blooded creature. I went and caught the rat, rather too easily, I think, and looked at its feet. I wanted to see what kind of little toenails it had, and what was the flesh like between its little toes, and I forgot the men entirely. It was their sudden silence that brought me back to myself. They were both staring dumbfounded at me. I smiled at them as innocently as I could, let the rat go, and went back to purchasing. Well, they never said anything about it, but there was a lesson in this. I had really frightened them. Later that night I gave my lawyer one last commission. He must send a present of 100 crowns to a theatre owner by the name of Renaud, with a note of thanks from me for his kindness. "Find out the situation with this little playhouse," I said. "Find out if there are any debts against it." Of course, I'd never go near the theatre. They must never guess what had happened, never be contaminated by it. And for now I had done what I could for all those I loved, hadn't I? And when all this was finished, when the church clock struck 3 over the white rooftops, and I was hungry enough to smell blood everywhere that I turned, I found myself standing in the empty Boulevard du Temple. The dirty snow had turned to slush under the carriage wheels, and I was looking at the House of Thespians, with its spattered walls and its torn playbills, and the name of the young mortal actor, Lestat de Valois, still written there in red letters. 10. The following nights were a rampage. I began to drink up Paris as if the city were blood. In the early evening I raided the worst sections, tangling with thieves and killers, often giving them a playful chance to defend themselves, then snarling them in a fatal embrace and feasting to a point of gluttony. I savored different types of kills. Big, lumbering creatures, small, wiry ones, the hirsute and the dark-skinned. But my favorite was the very young scoundrel who'd kill you for the coins in your pocket. I loved their grunting and cursing. Sometimes I held them with one hand and laughed at them till they were in a positive fury, and I threw their knives over the rooftops and smashed their pistols to pieces against the walls. But in all this, my full strength was like a cat never allowed to spring. And the one thing I loathed in them was fear. If a victim was really afraid, I usually lost interest. As time went on, I learned to postpone the kill. I drank a little from one, and more from another, and then took the grand wallop of the death itself from the third or the fourth one. It was the chase and the struggle that I was multiplying for my own pleasure. And when I'd had enough of all this hunting and drinking in an evening to content some 6 healthy vampires, I turned my eyes to the rest of Paris. All the glorious pastimes I couldn't afford before. But not before going to Roger's house for news of Nicholas or my mother. Her letters were brimming with happiness at my good fortune, and she promised to go to Italy in the spring if only she could get the strength to do it. Right now she wanted books from Paris, of course, and newspapers, and keyboard music for the harpsichord I'd sent. And she had to know, was I truly happy? Had I fulfilled my dreams? She was leery of wealth. I had been so happy at Renaud's. I must confide in her. It was agony to hear these words read to me. Time to become a liar in earnest, which I had never been. But for her, I would do it. As for Nicky, I should have known he wouldn't settle for gifts and vague tales, that he would demand to see me and keep on demanding it. He was frightening Roger a little bit. But it didn't do any good. There was nothing the attorney could tell him except what I've explained, and I was so wary of seeing Nicky that I didn't even ask for the location of the house into which he'd moved. I told the lawyer to make certain he studied with his Italian maestro and that he had everything he could possibly desire. But I did manage somehow to hear, quite against my will, that Nicholas hadn't quit the theatre. He was still playing at Renault's House of Thespians. Now this maddened me. Why the hell, I thought, should he do that? Because he loved it there, the same as I had, that was why. Did anybody really have to tell me this? We had all been kindred in that little rat-trap playhouse. Don't think about the moment when the curtain goes up, when the audience begins to clap and shout. No, send cases of wine and champagne to the theatre. Send flowers for Ginette and Lucina, the girls I had fought with the most and most loved, and more gifts of gold for Renaud, pay off the debts he had. But as the nights passed and these gifts were dispatched, Renaud became embarrassed about all this. A fortnight later, Roger told me Renaud had made a proposal. He wanted me to buy the House of Thespians and keep him on as manager with enough capital to stage larger and more wondrous spectacles than he'd ever before attempted. With my money and his cleverness, we could make the house the talk of Paris. I didn't answer right away. It took me more than a moment to realize that I could own the theatre just like that, own it like the gems in the chest, or the clothes I wore, or the dollhouse I'd sent to my nieces. I said no, and went out, slamming the door. Then I came right back. "All right, buy the theatre," I said, "and give him 10,000 crowns to do whatever he wants." This was a fortune, and I didn't even know why I had done this. "This pain will pass," I thought. "It has to, and I must gain some control over my thoughts, realize that these things cannot affect me. After all, where did I spend my time now? At the grandest theatres in Paris. I had the finest seats for the ballet and the opera and the dramas of Molière and Racine. I was hanging about before the footlights, gazing up at the great actors and actresses. I had suits made in every colour of the rainbow, jewels on my fingers, wigs in the latest fashion, shoes with diamond buckles as well as gold heels. And I had eternity to be drunk on the poetry I was hearing, drunk on the singing and the sweep of the dancers' arms, drunk on the organ throbbing in the great cavern of Notre Dame, and drunk on the chimes that counted out the hours to me, drunk on the snow falling soundlessly on the empty gardens of the Tuileries. And each night I was becoming less wary among mortals, more at ease with them. Not even a month had passed before I got up the courage to plunge right into a crowded ball at the Palais Royal. I was warm and ruddy from the kill, and at once I joined the dance. I didn't arouse the slightest suspicion. Rather, the women seemed drawn to me, and I loved the touch of their hot fingers and the soft crush of their arms and their breasts. After that I bore right into the early evening crowds in the boulevards. Rushing past Renault's, I squeezed into the other houses to see the puppet shows, the mimes and the acrobats. I didn't flee from street lamps any more. I went into cafes and bought coffee just to feel the warmth of it against my fingers. And I spoke to men when I chose. I even argued with them about the state of the monarchy, and I went madly into mastering billiards and card games, and it seemed to me I might go right into the House of Thespians if I wanted to, buy a ticket and slip up into the balcony and see what was going on. See Nicholas. Well, I didn't do that. What was I dreaming of to go near to Nicky? It was one thing to fool strangers, men and women who'd never known me, but what would Nicholas see if he looked into my eyes? What would he see when he looked at my skin? Besides, I had too much to do, I told myself. I was learning more and more about my nature and my powers. My hair, for example, was lighter, yet thicker, and grew not at all. Nor did my fingernails and toenails, which had a greater luster, though if I filed them away, they would regenerate during the day to the length they had been when I died. And though people couldn't discern such secrets on inspection, they sensed other things, an unnatural gleam to my eyes, too many reflected colours in them, and a faint luminescence to my skin. When I was hungry, this luminescence was very marked, all the more reason to feed. And I was learning that I could put people in thrall if I stared at them too hard, and my voice required very strict modulation. I might speak too low for mortal hearing, and were I to shout or laugh too loud, I could shatter another's ears. I could hurt my own ears. There were other difficulties. My movements. I tended to walk, to run, to dance, and to smile and gesture like a human being. But if surprised, horrified, grieved, my body could bend and contort like that of an acrobat. Even my facial expressions could be wildly exaggerated. Once forgetting myself as I walked in the Boulevard du Temple, thinking of Nicholas, naturally, I sat down beneath a tree, drew up my knees, and put my hands to the side of my head like a stricken elf in a fairy tale. 18th-century gentlemen in brocade frock coats and white silk stockings didn't do things like that, at least not on the street. And another time, while deep in contemplation of the changing of the light on surfaces, I hopped up and sat with my legs crossed on the top of a carriage, with my elbows on my knees. Well, this startled people. It frightened them. But, more often than not, even when frightened by the whiteness of my skin, they merely looked away. They deceived themselves. I quickly realized that everything was explainable. It was the rational 18th-century habit of mind. After all, there hadn't been a case of witchcraft in 100 years. The last that I knew of being the trial of La Voisin, a fortune-teller, burnt alive in the time of Louis the Sun King. And this was Paris. So if I accidentally crushed crystal glasses when I lifted them, or slammed doors back into the walls when opening them, people assumed I was drunk. But now and then I answered questions before mortals had asked them of me. I fell into stuporous states just looking at candles or tree branches, and didn't move for so long that people asked if I was ill. And my worst problem was laughter. I would go into fits of laughter, and I couldn't stop. Anything could set me off. The sheer madness of my own position might set me off. This can still happen to me fairly easily. No loss, no pain. No deepening understanding of my predicament changes it. Something strikes me as funny, I begin to laugh, and I can't stop. It makes other vampires furious, by the way, but I jump ahead of the tale. As you have probably noticed, I have made no mention of other vampires. The fact was I could not find any. I could find no other supernatural being in all of Paris. Mortals to the left of me, mortals to the right of me, and now and then, just when I'd convinced myself it wasn't happening at all, I'd feel that vague and maddeningly elusive presence. It was never any more substantial than it had been the first night in the village churchyard, and invariably it was in the vicinity of a Paris cemetery. Always I'd stop, turn, and try to draw it out. But it was never any good. The thing was gone before I could be certain of it. I could never find it on my own, and the stench of city cemeteries was so revolting I wouldn't, couldn't go into them. But this was coming to seem more than fastidiousness, or bad memories of my own dungeon beneath the tower. A revulsion at the sight or smell of death seemed part of my nature. I couldn't watch executions any more than when I was that trembling boy from the Auvergne, and corpses made me cover my face. I think I was offended by death, unless I was the cause of it, and I had to get clean away from my dead victims almost immediately. But to return to the matter of the presence, I came to wonder if it wasn't some other species of haunt, something that couldn't commune with me. On the other hand, I had the distinct impression that the presence was watching me, maybe even deliberately revealing itself to me. Whatever the case, I saw no other vampires in Paris, and I was beginning to wonder if there could be more than one of us at any given time. Maybe Magnus destroyed the vampire from whom he stole the blood. Maybe he had to perish once he passed on his powers, and I, too, would die if I were to make another vampire. But no, that didn't make sense. Magnus had had great strength even after giving me his blood, and he had bound his vampire victim in chains when he stole his powers. An enormous mystery, and a maddening one. But for the moment ignorance was truly bliss, and I was doing very well discovering things without the help of Magnus. And maybe this was what Magnus had intended. Maybe this had been his way of learning centuries ago. I remembered his words, that in the secret chamber of the tower I would find all that I needed to prosper. The hours flew as I roamed the city, and only to conceal myself in the tower by day did I ever deliberately leave the company of human beings. Yet I was beginning to wonder. If you can dance with them, and play billiards with them, and talk with them, then why can't you dwell among them just the way you did when you were living? Why couldn't you pass for one of them, and enter again into the very fabric of life where there is... what? Say it. And here it was nearly spring, and the nights were getting warmer, and the House of Thespians was putting on a new drama, with new acrobats between the acts, and the trees were in bloom again, and every waking moment I thought of Nicky. One night in March, I realized, as Roger read my mother's letter to me, that I could read as well as he could. I had learned from 1,000 sources how to read without even trying. I took the letter home with me. Even the inner chamber was no longer really cold, and I sat by the window reading my mother's words for the first time in private. I could almost hear her voice speaking to me. Nicholas writes that you have purchased Renault's. So you own the little theatre on the boulevard where you were so happy, but do you possess the happiness still? When will you answer me? I folded up the letter and put it in my pocket. The blood tears were coming into my eyes. Why must she understand so much, yet so little? 11. The wind had lost its sting. All the smells of the city were coming back, and the markets were full of flowers. I dashed to Roger's house without even thinking of what I was doing, and demanded that he tell me where Nicholas lived. I would just have a look at him, make certain he was in good health, be certain the house was fine enough. It was on the Ile Saint-Louis, and very impressive, just as I'd wanted. But the windows were all shuttered along the quays. I stood watching it for a long time, as one carriage after another roared over the nearby bridge, and I knew that I had to see Nicky. I started to climb the wall, just as I had climbed walls in the village, and I found it amazingly easy. One story after another I climbed, much higher than I had ever dared to climb in the past. And then I sped over the roof and down the inside of the courtyard to look for Nicky's flat. I passed a handful of open windows before I came to the right one. And then there was Nicholas, in the glare of the supper table. And Jeanette and Lucina were with him, and they were having the late-night meal that we used to take together when the theatre closed. At the first sight of him, I drew back away from the casement and closed my eyes. I might have fallen if my right hand hadn't held fast to the wall, as if with a will of its own. I had seen the room for only an instant, but every detail was fixed in my mind. He was dressed in old green velvet, finery he'd worn so casually in the crooked streets at home, but everywhere around him were signs of the wealth I'd sent him, leather-bound books on the shelves, and an inlaid desk with an oval painting above it, and the Italian violin gleaming atop the new pianoforte. He wore a jeweled ring I'd sent, and his brown hair was tied back with a black silk ribbon, and he sat brooding with his elbows on the table, eating nothing from the expensive china plate before him. Carefully, I opened my eyes and looked at him again. All his natural gifts were there in a blaze of light. The delicate but strong limbs, large, sober brown eyes, and his mouth that, for all the irony and sarcasm that could come out of it, was childlike and ready to be kissed. There seemed in him a frailty I'd never perceived or understood. Yet he looked infinitely intelligent, my Nicky, full of tangled, uncompromising thoughts as he listened to Jeanette, who was talking rapidly. "Lestat's married," she said as Lucina nodded. "The wife's rich, and he can't let her know he was a common actor. It's simple enough." "I say we let him in peace," Lucina said. "He saved the theatre from closing, and he showers us with gifts." "I don't believe it," Nicholas said bitterly. "He wouldn't be ashamed of us." There was a suppressed rage in his voice, an ugly grief. "And why did he leave the way he did? I heard him calling me. The window was smashed to pieces. I tell you, I was half awake, and I heard his voice." An uneasy silence fell among them. They didn't believe his account of things, how I'd vanished from the garret, and telling it again would only isolate him and embitter him further. I could sense this from all their thoughts. "You didn't really know Lestat," he said now, almost in a surly fashion, returning to the manageable conversation that other mortals would allow him. "Lestat would spit in the face of anyone who would be ashamed of us. He sends me money. What am I supposed to do with it? He plays games with us." No answer from the others, the solid, practical beings who would not speak against the mysterious benefactor. Things were going too well. And in the lengthening silence, I felt the depth of Nicky's anguish. I knew it as if I were peering into his skull, and I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear delving into his soul without his knowing it. Yet I couldn't stop myself from sensing a vast, secret terrain inside him, grimmer perhaps than I had ever dreamed, and his words came back to me that the darkness in him was like the darkness I'd seen at the inn, and that he tried to conceal it from me. I could almost see it, this terrain. And in a real way it was beyond his mind, as if his mind were merely a portal to a chaos stretching out from the borders of all we know. Too frightening, that. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to feel what he felt. But what could I do for him? That was the important thing. What could I do to stop this torment once and for all? Yet I wanted so to touch him. His hands, his arms, his face. I wanted to feel his flesh with these new immortal fingers. And I found myself whispering the word, "Alive." "Yes. You are alive, and that means you can die. And everything I see when I look at you is utterly insubstantial. It is a commingling of tiny movements and indefinable colours, as if you haven't a body at all, but are a collection of heat and light. You are light itself. And what am I now? Eternal as I am, I curl like a cinder in that blaze." But the atmosphere of the room had changed. Lucina and Jeanette were taking their leave with polite words. He was ignoring them. He had turned to the window, and he was rising as if he'd been called by a secret voice. The look on his face was indescribable. He knew I was there. Instantly I shot up the slippery wall to the roof, but I could still hear him below. I looked down and I saw his naked hands on the window ledge, and through the silence I heard his panic. He'd sensed that I was there. My presence, mind you, that is what he sensed, just as I sensed the presence in the graveyards. But how, he argued with himself, could Lestat have been here? I was too shocked to do anything. I clung to the roof gutter, and I could feel the departure of the others, feel that he was now alone. And all I could think was, what in the name of hell is this presence that he felt? I mean, I wasn't Lestat anymore. I was this demon, this powerful and greedy vampire, and yet he felt my presence. The presence of Lestat, the young man he knew. It was a very different thing from a mortal seeing my face and blurting out my name in confusion. He had recognized in my monster self something that he knew and loved. I stopped listening to him. I merely lay on the roof. But I knew he was moving below. I knew it when he lifted the violin from its place on the pianoforte, and I knew he was again at the window. And I put my hands over my ears. Still the sound came. It came rising out of the instrument and cleaving the night as if it were some shining element other than air and light and matter that might climb to the very stars. He bore down on the strings, and I could almost see him against my eyelids, swaying back and forth, his head bowed against the violin as if he meant to pass into the music, and then all sense of him vanished, and there was only the sound. The long, vibrant notes, and the chilling glissandos, and the violin singing in its own tongue to make every other form of speech seem false. Yet as the song deepened, it became the very essence of despair, as if its beauty were a horrid coincidence, grotesquery, without a particle of truth. Was this what he believed? What he had always believed when I talked on and on about goodness? Was he making the violin say it? Was he deliberately creating those long, pure, liquid notes to say that beauty meant nothing because it came from the despair inside him, and it had nothing to do with the despair, finally, because the despair wasn't beautiful, and beauty then was a horrid irony? I didn't know the answer, but the sound went beyond him as it always had. It grew bigger than the despair. It fell effortlessly into a slow melody, like water seeking its own downward mountain path. It grew richer and darker still, and there seemed something undisciplined and chastening in it, and heartbreaking and vast. I lay on my back on the roof now, with my eyes on the stars. Pinpoints of light mortals could not have seen. Phantom clouds, and the raw, piercing sound of the violin coming slowly, with exquisite tension, to a close. I didn't move. I was in some silent understanding of the language the violin spoke to me. Nicky, if we could talk again, if our conversation could only continue. Beauty wasn't the treachery he imagined it to be. Rather, it was an uncharted land where one could make a thousand fatal errors, a wild and indifferent paradise without signposts of evil or good. In spite of all the refinements of civilization that conspired to make art, the dizzying perfection of the string quartet, or the sprawling grandeur of Fragonard's canvases, beauty was savage. It was as dangerous and lawless as the earth had been eons before man had one single coherent thought in his head, or wrote codes of conduct on tablets of clay. Beauty was a savage garden. So why must it wound him that the most despairing music is full of beauty? Why must it hurt him and make him cynical and sad and untrusting? Good and evil, those are concepts man has made. And man is better, really, than the savage garden. But maybe deep inside Nicky had always dreamed of a harmony among all things that I had always known was impossible. Nicky had dreamed not of goodness, but of justice. But we could never discuss these things now with each other. We could never again be in the inn. Forgive me, Nicky. Good and evil exist still as they always will, but our conversation is over forever. Yet even as I left the roof, as I stole silently away from the Ile Saint-Louis, I knew what I meant to do. I didn't admit it to myself, but I knew. The next night it was already late when I reached the Boulevard du Temple. I'd fed well in the Ile de la Cité, and the first act of Renaud's House of Thespians was already under way. 12. I'd dressed as if I were going to court, in silver